Welcome to 2020. Jeffrey Epstein still didn't kill himself. All that and more on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men in this country, just shut up, do the right thing for a change.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
Whoop, there it is.
That's it. Welcome back to The Uprising. Happy New Year, everybody. Happy New Year, Mr. Tim Donner, who joins me not in studio, but from parts unknown. Welcome back to The Uprising for 2020, Tim.
It's sad that at this stage of development that I still have to use the from parts unknown thing in order to get attention that I ought to be getting for being right out in the open. But, you know, so goes the fortunes.
Tim, we have war, maybe, yes, maybe, no. We've got Equal Rights Amendment on the plate. Legislators going crazy in Virginia. But first, I want to talk about drugs. And this story is, of course, it's as fresh as a daisy because the tension between our federal and state drug laws exists in great order. The more the states legalize and liberalize, the greater that tension becomes. And we had a great story out of Illinois where they actually ran out of marijuana for their they got legal sales on January 1, and they couldn't fulfill the demand. But more importantly than that, they pardoned like 11,000 people the day before the governor. And they also enacted a law where gun owners weren't subject to prosecution if they happened to have marijuana in the state. So that's where things start.
Well, I think that this is an issue that would ordinarily be kind of front and center because it's a fundamental change in American law and culture as well, having this stuff be legal as opposed to illegal. But in the current political climate, it won't get as much play as it might, say, in 2019 or 2021. But I think it's pretty clear, Scott. I mean, we've talked about it almost endlessly. The march is inevitable in one direction. And it's more now, I think, a matter of which states are going to make recreational, now known as non-prescription weed, legal as opposed to those who will only allow medical, now known as prescription weed.
Yeah, well, the difference, and it's important to say it, I think rhetorically it makes a difference, and you know, people buy without a prescription for medical purposes. That's the reason why. Everybody doesn't have to go and get a prescription if you want, you know, the medical benefit. So, and we know that it is used. You know, all mammals have cannabinoid receptors. This is not something that, you know, is like hypoxia, where it like removes something from the human body that's necessary in order to induce euphoria or something like that. And I just think that the more we move in a direction where that is recognized and not punished, we're in good shape. Tim, I think that we skated by an important kind of milestone in the war on drugs when we didn't talk about Pete Buttigieg's comments. Do you know the ones that I'm referring to?
Well, before we go there, I just wanted to say one thing as an addendum to what you said about weed before. And, you know, the cannabinoid receptors, that's a real thing. And one of the reasons I know that is because I know someone who uses CBD, which is, it's a non-psychoactive form of the same thing. which is now used for pain relief for many, many people. And so that has sort of popularized the whole cannabinoid receptor things, because people go on the web and they say, why do these CBD pads work? Why does the CBD cream work? And it does work for a lot of people. So it's sort of moving it into a very popular
medical prescription. It's at the gas station next to the mints and such.
Yeah, I mean, these days, it's on the rise in terms of popularity. And it all speaks to that same thing, the cannabinoid receptor. That's why it works.
Well, we don't have meth receptors or... I don't know what the analogous is for cocaine, but I think that it was a pretty
well. What about alcohol? What about what? Do we have alcohol receptors, so to speak?
You know, the way that the body, we have the ability to metabolize alcohol through the liver, but I don't know in terms of the pathways with which, you know, why are we intoxicated? That's something I haven't studied with alcohol, like I have with marijuana. But Mayor Pete had this to say about the decriminalization of possession of all kinds of drugs. And I didn't want it to go unmentioned here, because we do spend so much time talking about the drug war. And even though I don't think Mayor Pete has done a single thing to lift a finger for any of the people that he could actually help as mayor in terms of directing his police forces to not, you know, enforce these laws. But in any case, it's some progress. Here's Mayor Pete.
Incarceration should not even be a response to drug possession.
Is that across the board? So if it's meth or coke or ecstasy, any drugs, if it's possession, incarceration isn't.
That's right.
Incarceration, Tim, has no place for simple drug possession. That's pretty remarkable from a president of the United States candidate, if he means it.
Well, I mean, you would expect him to be one who's going to be willing to break barriers, because after all, he's the first openly gay man to run for president. So he's already broken a huge barrier. So why not, you know, draw attention to yourself by making a, some would say, provocative statement like that about drugs. But you know what? It just gives me an opportunity to say something I've been meaning to say for a while. And that is, what a gifted politician Pete Buttigieg really is. If you look at where he's come from, a guy who's by most accounts, not a terribly successful mayor of a very small town in the Midwest, famous, you know, only because of the location of Notre Dame being there. And he got, you know, thrashed in a statewide race, and then he runs for president.
By the way, the backhanded compliment is, this is the best backhanded compliment I've ever heard.
No, you have to hear the end of it. Because a guy like that was basically laughed off the stage when he entered the race. Like, Pete, what? And who? And he's gay, and he's from Indiana, and he lost by like 30 points or something when he ran for statewide office. All of this. But then he steps on the stage, and it's almost like, Scott, like a triple-A pitcher who struggles and doesn't really perform that well in the minors. But then when he gets to the majors, some kind of switch flicks. And Buttigieg came out and appealed to people who wanted, you know, someone who sounded calm and reasonable. And he tacked to the left when that was required early on in the primaries. And he said all the right things for the lefties. And then as we get closer to it, he's now noticed he's tacked cleverly and effectively to the center to make him sound,
Tim, I think,
more
like
a moderate.
Most, a surprising thing that you just did and said was go ahead and choose. Really, we're recording right now. It's January 9th that you would use one of your few allotted baseball analogies so early in the year.
Well, I'm getting ready for spring training, Scott. You got to understand, baseball fans count the days till pitchers and catchers report to spring training religiously.
That's number two, by the way. You better zip it right now.
You want to understand, but here's the point of it. Here's the point about Buttigieg. I think he is a very gifted politician. He's not going to win this time, but he's going to make some noise in Iowa, New Hampshire, maybe a little bit beyond that. But I think they're really honestly looking at 2024, because I think they know they're not going to beat Trump unless something cataclysmic happens, which is always possible when Trump's in the White House.
I would say the benefit is it's going to force other candidates to be more liberal in their positions on the criminalization of drug possession. So I think he might actually move the needle away from the drug
war. I think he might. Were it not for the fact that he's singularly unattractive to black voters, Pete Buttigieg would be a serious contender to that sort of moderate lane, so to speak.
For people who are
that's
looking
occupied
for a mayor
by Joe Biden.
A not very successful mayor of a city that is otherwise unremarkable, except for a certain
I'll tell you what, we haven't stopped to really...
athletic program, right?
We haven't stopped to really, you know, think about how remarkable it is that the guy's even, you know, in the top five.
Well, listen, in a world
this
where
late in the race,
Donald Trump is president, anything is possible. Let's turn our attention, Tim, to the Old Dominion, Virginia, and boy, it is to say that it is popping nationally with especially the gun laws. I mean, really, there's other laws too that the new majority Democrats are going to go for. As I think yesterday was the start of the session. For the first time since 1994, Democrats have a majority in the Virginia legislature, and they have pre-filed bills that are so hostile to gun rights that they've engendered this backlash where we have this sanctuary county movement, over 100, as you said on the radio, over 100 cities and independent counties and cities have signed on to these Second Amendment sanctuary bills or resolutions, which typically say we're not going to cooperate with attempts to seize the people's guns. Because that's what the legislators say they're going to do. Governor Northam's crazy hostile against gun rights, and they want to turn Virginia, which is one of the states that has more respect for gun rights, generally speaking, in terms of rankings, and turn it into like Berkeley, California, basically.
I'm deeply concerned about it. I mean, I really am, and I'm not just using those political words, deeply concerned. I mean, I really am. It's
you're not
a tinderbox.
Like Nancy Pelosi, deeply concerned. You're Tim Donner.
And more gas keeps being thrown on the fire by both sides, by the gun rights people who refuse to abide by surrendering or, at best, compromising an absolute constitutional right, and the people on the other side intent on removing, watering down, you know, ultimately eliminating that right. It's obvious that if the Second Amendment came up today, there's no question that the left of center all the way over to the extreme left, which seems to dominate the Democratic Party these days, they would all forego a Second Amendment. And they'd use the argument probably, well, we're the only ones in the world that have a Second Amendment, and the rest of the world is so much more peaceful than us, Scott.
I think that, so there were two articles I wrote about it this week. One was this legislator who got caught on an open mic saying that gun owners were like children and that they just had to not respond to their, basically their protestations. And that was item number one, which, you know, it's one thing to suggest that somebody's wrong and you disagree with them, but to dismiss them, that to me is where the poison is. What kind of response is that going to get? It's one thing if somebody listens to you and they just disagree with you. And there's plenty of room on the gun issue for people to be, you know, to be able to disagree without being disagreeable or to hate somebody. But to basically say you're a child because you think it's important that people... Go ahead.
You know, we already have a lot of gun laws. I mean, we're not talking about instituting the first gun laws in the history of the United States. In various states, they have various laws with various levels of severity. So, I mean, it's like saying, I support free trade as if we have free trade now.
Tim,
we don't. So,
though,
I mean, these terms get thrown around liberally.
We can argue about the free trade, but if you say to me, I'm not even going to listen to your argument about free trade.
Right, exactly.
Okay?
But this is the way, this is the climate we're in these days.
And it's a fundamental right.
It's no longer a matter of whether, from the leftist perspective, whether we're wrong. It's that we must be stopped.
well,
that
that's,
we're
yeah.
evil,
so that,
we're
so
racist,
that brings us,
we're
Tim,
white
to,
supremacists, whatever.
Tim, that brings us to Delegate Dan Helmer's legislation. He pre-filed it before the session started. HB 567 is the title for anybody who wants to look it up. And all it does is outlaws, literally. I mean, like, I keep putting these qualifiers in it because people hear about it. It's like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. You're right. It doesn't make any sense. What it does is it outlaws the NRA's range in Fairfax, Virginia. At NRA headquarters, there's a super state-of-the-art range. You and I have both been there and shot there a bunch of times. And it's a great range. It's the headquarters range for the NRA. It's just exactly what you would expect the nation's most prominent gun rights organizations to have as their range. And this guy hates the NRA, Dan Helmer. So he just says if a range has more than 50 employees who work in the building and it's not owned by the government, then it's banned. And basically only one range applies in that anybody can think of in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It just happens to be the NRA range.
This is what I call, Scott, the vendetta culture, or the cancel culture is the popular term for it, where if you have a personal distaste or dislike of somebody else, what you do is you simply eliminate their basic constitutional rights to talk, to assemble, even to do business. This is the new superhighway for the left. Simply mow people down by calling them white supremacists or racists or misogynists or any of those things. Just call them that, and it just shuts down conversation and immediately establishes that you're not just wrong, you're evil. We think they're wrong. They think we're evil.
It's this guy's actions that to me are evil. Like, it's one thing, like, so he has, for instance, Delegate Helmer has introduced a like safe storage law where, like, if you have a gun in a car, you can't leave it there. You have to have some kind of locked container, some thing that I consider to be an impermissible restriction on Second Amendment rights. But also, I don't consider it to be his attempt to disarm Virginians. Like, that it's just something I disagree with him about, okay? But I don't like kind of hate him for that. But this, it does make me hate this person, because he's trying to use the power of his office to settle a private grudge and basically just frustrate the will of all these people who live and work and shoot at this place and enjoy their lives. And he's going to just use his office to screw with them.
Well, let me bring it back to you, because I think you're a very good example of the downdraft, the unintended consequences, the fallout of the extremism that we're witnessing from the left. You're a guy who you voted for Trump, even though you voted libertarian your whole life, because you were so scared of the idea of Hillary Clinton. Great. But you were hardly a Trump loyalist. You just thought he was the lesser of the two evils, so to speak. But now that he's been in office and you see what they're doing to him and what they're doing to gun rights and what they're doing to basic constitutional protections, you said, what was it, a few weeks ago on the podcast, I'll put up a Trump 2020 sign on my lawn. And the reason I say that is because I think there's a lot of people who were like, all right, I'll hold my breath and roll the dice on Donald Trump. And then when he became president, they're like, this guy's record is good, even though he hates the tweets and the bombast and all that. But then when he's attacked like this by these people who were just frightening the bejesus out of the American people with these witch hunts on Trump from end to end, no legislation, and just a stream of hatred, that.
Well, wait just a second.
They're
there,
just
Tim,
driving.
Conflated Trump derangement syndrome with what I think is an important differentiator, which is an assault on the civil rights of the people that have elected them to go to the statehouse. So,
well. And so what they've done is they've driven people like yourself into the waiting and welcome arms of the Trump camp, because people look at this and they go, you know, Trump, boy, I mean, he's there's the headlines every day, et cetera. But boy, are we really prepared to roll the dice on the stuff we're seeing coming out of the left? I mean,
Plenty of Virginians are in favor of increased gun control laws. I think that they're
true.
They're in favor of them because they've been sold a bill of goods. But I think a fair reading of the polls of the majority would suggest they are in favor of them. But at what cost? You know, part of the role of a politician, one of the reasons why we have a representative democracy, is to understand that while there's a broad, shallow support for some new gun control laws, there is a giant, deep, significant minority support for leaving the freedoms we have in place. And, you know, are these people, you know, I want to talk about the Equal Rights Amendment in a second. And we are going to talk about the kind of War Powers Act and, you know, stuff later on. But it's like the Equal Rights Amendment. I'm sure some of those people thought that the Equal Rights Amendment is a good idea. But do you want to spend resources that the Commonwealth has fighting for the enactment of this in, like, the federal courts? Is that what, you know, it's like, you're laughing because it's like, is that how people want their tax money used? Like,
the left is just astounding with one thing after another, which are consistently labeled, even for them, that's got to be the worst thing I've ever seen. And then they bring back the Equal Rights Amendment, which is dead as a doornail. But, you know, there was some window there where they could get some other states to go along with it.
I can't imagine any of Dan Helmer's constituents want their tax dollars to go to fight court battles over eliminating the NRA's range to settle a grudge.
I just figured it out.
Go ahead.
Okay, here's what it is. It's a Back to the Future thing. It's a celebrating Joe Biden thing. It's a let's talk about busing, and then let's talk about the Equal Rights Amendment, and take us back to the wonderful days of the 70s with Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter. Oh, wait. Maybe not. Oh, I think so. I mean, the Equal Rights Amendment, after we talked about busing in a Democratic debate in 2020 for an issue that was dead like 35 years ago.
You can tell me if you think this is a correct characterization, because you were, and I don't often like to point to how you exceed me in years lived on this earth, but in this case, it is relevant because you were more of an adult when this was all going on than I
was.
So,
right.
But as I recall, or has studied in the history books, Tim, the Equal Rights Amendment was almost like a foregone conclusion. It was pretty well headed to passage, and Phyllis Schlafly and some conservative Americans decided this was really an anti-woman bill from their perspective, from people who have kind of traditional beliefs about womanhood and a differentiation between the sex, and basically stopped it dead in its tracks by highlighting that what it would do would actually sort of hurt women rather than help them. Is that?
Well, I think a lot of these things that are intended to help women do hurt them. I mean, I think the Me Too movement really has hurt women.
Well, sure, but is that a fair reading? Is that a fair reading of the facts that you recall them with the passage of the ERA or lack thereof?
I don't recall that final stage where there were the last few states that apparently Schlafly made this a big push at. But it was something that it was the feminist cause of the 1970s. And then when it went away, I mean, it went away during the Reagan era and it never came back until the left resurrected it. In the same year that they've, you know, gone on record as supporting taxpayer funding for transgender abortions.
Yeah. Well, this looks like another Virginia issue.
Just a yeah on that? Just a yeah?
Well, it's so ridiculous.
That's it?
I think we've covered it well enough. We haven't covered the ERA. And this is another one of those things where it's like, is that really what the Democrats in Virginia think they've been sent to the Capitol to fight about? Is that issue? It seems like it seems like they're not using their sort of efforts to economize on their power. You know, they have a limited amount of juice. What can you get done? That's where you're putting your lead foot.
Just to put what I said about the Me Too movement in perspective, what that's done is created an increased hesitancy in the marketplace to hire women. If there's a doubt, you're probably not, I mean, let's be honest, you're probably not going to hire the woman if you're afraid that there's going to be a sexual harassment suit, that you're going to be accused of things. It's an unintended consequence of this movement. And, you know, likewise, the ERA was something where it would have created just endless fights about gender rights, and it would have been incredibly divisive for a right, which, again, Scott, I said this on the radio show, a right that's already guaranteed in the United States Constitution.
Well, yeah, except for, I don't know that you can say that it's entirely redundant, meaning, in fact, I think that a lot of opponents of the Equal Rights Amendment would say, Tim, it's not the same thing as the current, protections in law. In fact, what it would do is kind of re-engineer society in a way, maybe without gender or sex. And then how does that, you know, like in terms of pregnancy, you know, rules about it, laws and abort. I mean, it does present, you know, when there are things, you know, there is a man and there is a woman and there, you know, yeah, I don't know how the law would reckon with all the changes that would be required, but it is just a bit different than I think saying the protections exist. But when they sell it like this will mean that we're legally equal. And in fact, you're right there. The Constitution does provide, and as interpreted, that men and women are legally entitled to the same rights. They're just not the same because they are not identical. They are different.
Okay, can we have a discussion about busing now?
About busing? Where did that? You're just rehashing.
I mean, these are all these uh-huh. these. You know, it's like right. listening to the 70s on 7 on Sirius XM radio.
By the way,
with all
fine,
these issues like busing
idea.
And the Equal Rights Amendment,
getting some poor black kid out of bed at 5:30 in the morning for like a 2-hour, multi bus trip around town.
It was very popular.
Chris Rock had a line about that.
Oh yeah. Oh, that was so good.
All right. Well, let's get to the war, or lack thereof. We had the attack against General Suleiman, or whatever his name is, in Iraq. Yes, and we had, I think, I don't know, did they? Should we check the news, Tim? Did they pass it yet? Did the House pass the War Powers Act rebuke kind of resolution that they had teed up?
Yes, they did.
Okay, well, there you go. Hot off the presses. I was asked, forget about, and you wrote about it for LibertyNation.com about how you think that this could be an impetus for Trump to kind of fulfill a promise to sort of withdraw our troops from the Mideast in meaningful ways. But before we get into that nuanced part of the discussion, when you first heard about it, what was your thought about Donald Trump's use of force in this manner?
Well, my thought was that this was a third strike of a significant terrorist target after Osama bin Laden and al-Baghdadi. That was the first thought. But upon even initial review, it's clear that this takeout, this execution is the proper term for it.
Yeah, assassination, execution.
Was of a far greater significance because this is a general, the number two guy in Iran, a guy who has, you know, spread so much terror and death. He's really a mass murderer is what he is, and the fact that he wore the uniform, a national military uniform, somehow confers on him a level of respectability that a common terrorist would not hold. That's just nonsense. The guy was a mass murderer. So, my first thought when we discovered it was that, well, what was he doing meeting with those Iraqi proxies, pro-Iranian proxies, openly on an airfield?
Well, Iran has been using proxies and seconds to conduct wars ever since the Islamic Republic was born, right? I mean, that's sort of one of the ways they've been doing it. And we've been ignoring it ever since, what, 79? And not holding them accountable for the acts of their proxies, including the Marine base, including, I mean, you count it, right? I mean, it goes back.
That's absolutely right. And I think when Trump had enough of not retaliating over three or four strikes, none of which killed Americans, but all of which were, you know, hostile military actions, he had enough when the American embassy was attacked in Baghdad. That was it for him. And when he found out who was responsible and then considered the background of this guy who has been one of the most brutal and significant terrorists in the entire region, I don't think it was that difficult a decision for him. That was the sense that I got because, you know, he's not a guy. Look, Trump is not a guy who wants to use a military power. He wants to have all of it as a veil, but he doesn't want to use it. He said that consistently. That's why he got our troops out of Syria when Turkey was invading.
Well, saying it is one thing and actually getting the troops out is another, and I salute his actions, you know, with the exception of this use of force. Forget about what he said, Tim, because for politicians, words are as cheap as they come, but what he's done is to generally not engage militarily with the enemy. So, or people who could be perceived as that. So I salute that. And anytime he does engage it, though, I think we want to be skeptical, even though he has been reserved or circumspect with the use of force.
Oh,
that doesn't mean, you know, I'm against this whole notion where I don't know where, you know, I see that you have some of the Mike Lee clip, like this notion where some, you know, executive somebody in the executive has said that the legislature should not be examining their actions or questioning them. And it's like, well, oh, no, that's exactly what we should be doing.
But in real time, Scott, consider the notion of Donald Trump in this political climate saying, yeah, we need to strike this guy while he's meeting with these, because the Iraqis that were killed in that strike were very significant terrorist figures as well, Scott. Are we going to miss this opportunity so that we can go up to the Hill and put it in the hands of Nancy Pelosi to give me
go ahead and take
military action? But, I mean, that's basically, but that's what the Democrats have been saying that Trump should have done. And the patent absurdity of that in this instance where you're taking out a guy who is essentially a terrorist mastermind with the authority of a state power. It makes him worse than a regular terrorist.
we need some kind of reimagining of how military power works in the country, because the Congress has the power to declare war, okay? Let's say, and I'm not willing to say this is a given, but let's, for our purposes right now, let's say standing armies are a given, that technology and the cost and development of modern warfare requires some kind of a standing army, because ideally we would not have a standing army. And then we'd only have the president using an army when Congress authorized one to go to war. But let's just say we had a standing army because that's how we had to go now. The idea that we would allow any one person, Tim, to kind of write a check in blood for us against the lives of others, I think and it has nothing to do whether that person is Donald J. Trump, Barack Hussein Obama, Hillary, or any booty judge, whatever, but that one person that we, how many hundred million are we? 350 million, something like that, less, whatever, that we
but
all
that,
grant this
that's
one
the
guy.
Power. But that's the power that's been conferred upon the commander in chief.
Yeah, and I'm suggesting that we shouldn't.
Extraordinarily broad powers.
Well, no, he has the power as the commander in chief, but the Congress has the power to declare war, and they're not using it like that. So that's supposed to be the most democratic you know, the most responsive to the public body, right? The closest to the people.
Yes.
But that's not what we have.
Correct. No, it's a legislature going amok. I mean, that's why their approval numbers are about the equivalent of used car salesmen, Scott, because people don't trust them. They don't believe anything they say. When Nancy Pelosi stands up there and says it's a sad time, it's very somber that we're forced to impeach this corrupt president, you know, and everybody, 100% of people watching know that to be untrue. When Adam Schiff...
Well, it's also funny that she's not
recites
even...
recites a fairy tale. I mean, you know...
Well, she hasn't even sent the sent the thing over. That's how you know it's all BS.
No.
The idea that it had to be done, and you know, sooner rather than later. Look, the way she should say it is just send it over. You know, we hope that the Senate will do their job, but we're not confident they will. But we've done ours, and here it is. Here are these articles which we regretfully had to enact. You know.
Now let's go back to Iran and what you were saying about it. And I think the paradox of this situation, when the drums of war are supposedly beating, they really aren't. I think Trump properly de-escalated after that strike by the Iranians that didn't kill anybody.
Well, that's because they de-escalated. They could have killed a lot of people if they wanted to.
They could have.
They de-escalated.
He responded to their de-escalation by not flexing his muscles more than he needed to. But paradoxically, this situation, and this is what I wrote about in my column this week on LibertyNation.com,
Tim,
Trump's golden opportunity
of today's program,
to
LibertyNation.com, your source for conservatarian news and analysis, 24/7, 365. Please go ahead.
A great site, even when the title of a brilliant column is interrupted mid-sentence. Okay, just so people know. Okay, so let me try. Take two. Scott, I wrote a column on LibertyNation.com, and it's called Trump's Golden Opportunity to Leave the Middle East. And the point is that paradoxically, this showdown with Iran has given Trump the opening to do what he has said that he intends to do, which is to withdraw, not overnight, but to withdraw steadily, if not dramatically, our presence, our military presence in the Middle East. And he did that with this response. Now, there's three basic points. The three pressure points that he put on Iran makes it that much easier for him to make the decision to pull back our military presence. The first one is that he projected his own political will to do the strike that he did. He said, that was a statement, I'm willing to do it. Number two, he showed off military might that was truly frightening to anyone else in the world. And number three, the economic sanctions, which are already crippling Iran's economy, he ramped them up even further. So he's using the deterrent of American military and economic might to punish Iran in a way that says, you know, we don't need to use our weapons because we've got them and we'll use them. It's the playground bully philosophy you were taught by your parents, Scott. Don't start a fight, but if they start one and they provoke you, you sure as heck will finish it. And I think that's what the statement was. And because of that, I think we're in a perfect position now, Scott, to start withdrawing our presence. Now, we can't do it overnight because Iran has said they will force us out of the Middle East. So if we just leave now, it'll project a kind of weakness. But we can start now. We can start the process.
Yeah, the projections to me are less important than the reality. If it would yield, you know, Iran wants to be a regional hegemon. They want to control what's going on in that sector
of
the
world.
Right. Just like we want to control what's going on, near us. What means and methods that they use to do that are what's important, though. And, I'm in favor of holding them to account for, you know, if they start giving IED technology to people that are using it against Americans, we should hold them accountable for it, it seems to me. I wish we would have gone. I'm not in favor of war with Iran. I want to say that explicitly. But I wish that instead of all the 14 other wars that we've done against in other places around the Middle East that seem to have been fought in some part by Iranian proxies, we could have just gone to war against them, you know, to start with and settled it.
You know that the moment that Trump announces that he's pulling back our military presence in Iraq and perhaps elsewhere, that the immediate response will be that Iran will now expand its empire throughout the Middle East.
Yeah,
it's already done it through proxies, through which are essentially military mercenaries, right? Mercenary terrorist groups who will go anything that's anti-U.S., anti-Israel, they'll sign up and get paid to do what they do. You know, these groups, the Iranians and those who work for them, they're, you know, are they the only bad guys in the region? I mean, that's my point. Who are the good guys in the region?
Oh, yeah. You don't need to sell. You don't need to sell. Get us the hell out of there to me, Tim. Get us the hell out of there times a million.
Who are the good guys in the region?
Where's Thomas Jefferson in Syria that we can find and install in power? Yeah, there are.
There are no good guys in the region. So I say, especially given the key point, Scott, which is that we no longer need their oil, why the hell are we still going to stay there? Are we going to have a permanent military presence?
We shouldn't have been there for the oil in the first place. We can't. Look, half of Americans, or call it 30%, whatever the Trump derangement syndrome types are, think that we have Adolf Hitler in the White House. So they, even by their own, you know, morality, judgment, whatever, Americans can't even pick a decent leader for themselves. How the hell are we going to pick decent leaders for other places where we've never even been? You know, it's just hubris.
Well, the point is, there's just no reason. And this is, you know, Trump is a businessman. So he looks at something and like, does this make sense? And he's saying to himself, as most Americans will now, because it's a teachable moment, why are we still over there? What's the purpose? What interest are we protecting? What vital American national interests are we protecting? Oil? Okay, that was the reason for as long as we can remember. But it's no longer oil. We don't need their oil. We're energy independent. And that's the sole reason to be involved in that tinderbox where it's just insane all the time. Why would we want to be there unless we absolutely have to? If Iran and Syria and Russia and China and Saudi Arabia want to fight it out with all the terrorist groups for who controls the region.
Yeah, we have more energy now.
Let them.
We have more energy now than we did before. I just don't think that our lack of, you know, being able to produce all we used before justified our presence there. We should have been out way back then too.
I'm not saying it did, but I'm saying that
there's less of a reason now. I get
the actual reason.
No, the justification
there's really not less of a reason. There's not less of a reason. There's no reason other than to protect our own national interests there, and that can be
Tim,
done
it's the Bush
without a military
with,
presence on the ground.
The Saudis combined with the Clintons that keeps us there in the petrodollar. That's you want to you know, peel the
onion. We've got various reactions. I want to sort of take you through, I think the most important thing is to sort of take you through what Trump said on various things during his speech, which was, I think it was an important speech, a potentially pivotal speech, a speech that could lay the groundwork for a very different international relations going forward. Doesn't mean it will be, but the groundwork is laid with it. With this speech, and so the first thing he did was describe just how evil this General Soleimani really was. That you played Trump Soleimani.
Soleimani was personally responsible for some of the absolutely worst atrocities. He trained terrorist armies, including Hezbollah, launching terror strikes against civilian targets. He fueled bloody civil wars all across the region. He viciously wounded and murdered thousands of U.S. troops, including the planting of roadside bombs that maim and dismember their victims. In recent days, he was planning new attacks on American targets, but we stopped him. Soleimani's.
Well, that to me, by the way, I mean, just forgetting for a second, he could have been the worst mass murderer in history in Iran or something else, but it's the future, it's the planning of future attacks, and that to me is, okay, now we're talking about a justice, because there's plenty of people who have committed past attacks against Americans, you know, in war that, you know, they're state actors, but new attacks, if there's really good evidence for them. And Tim, I have to say, you know, we've been lied to so many times by so many governments and government officials about this kind of thing that we have to be skeptical. But for our purposes now, I'll take him at his word that that's accurate and a profoundly reasonable justification to take the guy out.
Well, I think the way to judge someone's actions, Scott, going forward, are to look at his actions going backwards. This is a guy who has instituted the slaughter of thousands of people. He's proven himself willing to do almost anything, roadside bombs, IUDs, maiming people, murdering civilians at will. This guy's willing to do anything. So I think that certainly makes it far more plausible that he was planning something else, because he was running, look, he's running roughshod over the Middle East because he was getting no opposition. People were scared to death of him. He put the fear of God in people because he was murdering people left and right and getting away with it and doing it with impunity. And then all of a sudden, boom, his bubble burst. And he's not a guy who's going to be easily replaced. So if you don't think Iran was thrown back on its heels by this this execution, think again.
Well, now, like I said, to the extent that it saves U.S. lives, I'm in favor of it, to be sure. But
absolutely.
I'm not willing to just, you know, I brusque at the notion. I still have that sort of Mike Lee reaction in my brain, which is that, you know, the idea that that there should be no questions asked is, or to ask questions is somehow like helping the enemy. Anytime I hear any talk remotely like that, I really want to just stand up and say, whoa, whoa, whoa. That is what that's what a tyrant says. You can't question me or you're helping the enemy.
That's certainly not appropriate. Now, we weren't in that meeting, so we've had different accounts.
Yeah.
But we know that at least Rand Paul and Mike Lee were very angry about it, and we'll talk about that. But just to finish off on Trump, basically, here's a summary of what he's now saying about the positioning of the U.S. and Iran and, you know, our foreign policy going forward and or how we can project our own strength as a deterrent, not as a reason to go to war.
We are now the number one producer of oil and natural gas anywhere in the world. We are independent, and we do not need Middle East oil. The fact that we have this great military and equipment, however, does not mean we have to use it. We do not want to use it. American strength, both military and economic, is the best deterrent.
Okay, so I think that just summarizes the entire Trump foreign policy right there.
Yeah, well, I mean, so far it's been so good. I think that I appreciate his responding to the Iranian de-escalation with more de-escalation. You know, we learned. I mean, I think that it's the North Korean thing that you know, really I learned about Trump's foreign policy, which is, you know, he's for engagement and trying to move the needle, and I appreciate that.
Now, let's do one more Trump, which is the conclusion of this sort of trilogy here, because the first is he establishes the evil of Soleimani, and he went on to describe all the documented cases of Iranian terror and expansionist expansionist tyranny, so to speak, throughout the region. But then at the end, he got to what I think he's really interested in as a deal maker.
Iran must abandon its nuclear ambitions and end its support for terrorism. The time has come for the United Kingdom, Germany, France, Russia, and China to recognize this reality. They must now break away from the remnants of the Iran deal, or JCPOA. And we must all work together toward making a deal with Iran that makes the world a safer and more peaceful place.
Okay, so what he's doing there, Scott, is basically playing the deal maker. This is what turns him on. This is what he is. He's made his life of art of the deal. He wants to make a deal with Iran. He wants to make a decent deal. And I think he's proven with North Korea, among others, that he's willing to play the long game and be patient and work incrementally. Obviously, that's the case with China as well. And I think part of his strategy, I would infer, is to force Iran to the negotiating table, because we're going to crush them with economic sanctions. We've already taken out really their number one guy. He's the number two guy, but functionally, he's number one. We've done all of that. We're going to ramp up the sanctions. Trump has proven he's willing to crush them on a moment's notice if necessary. I think that's what forces a country to the negotiating table. So I think that's his strategy. Whether it works remains to be seen, but I think it seems to make sense, at least in principle.
Well, Tim, anything that gets us further away from another country having offensive nuclear weapons, the better, because the more that are out there, the more likely somebody will follow the U.S. example and use them. And we got to make sure that doesn't happen if we can.
Now, we got different reactions from within the Republican Party. The so-called libertarian wing, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, had one reaction. But let's start with Lindsey Graham, who I think went a little bit overboard in his praise of the president's speech, but also exhibited a surprising appreciation for the president pulling back from conflict rather than going towards it, which is what Lindsey Graham has usually stood
for.
Well,
the dig on Graham is that he's a war hawk and he never met a war
right. That
he didn't
exactly.
like, and he was in league with John McCain for their entire Senate runs together, basically supporting any kind of new hostility is sort of the thing.
Yep.
Now that he's Trump's best friend, I guess maybe the tide's turned.
Yeah, he's pivoted.
Go ahead.
He's pivoted, Scott. He's pivoted.
Excuse me, Tim. I forgot about that. That's what a politician does. They don't follow the way their bread is buttered. They pivot. Here we go.
The president made a very bold decision today to allow things to calm down. This speech will be talked about long after his second term. This is on par with tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev. This is resetting the...
My God, he's teeny bopper with a crush here.
Relationship between the world and Iran, just not the United States. The president said there's an evil empire in Iran that's bent on destroying the world, killing the people in Israel and coming after us, and I will no longer tolerate it.
But notice his appreciation for the president stepping back. So that's at least a step in the right direction, that he's not trying to beat the drums of war.
Agreed.
Which you might have expected. On the other hand, the decision to go and conduct this strike that took out these people, including Soleimani, was something that we talked about congressional oversight. They have a legitimate reason to know why this was done. Now, Scott, we've said for a long time, and it's sort of implicit, that, when someone like Maxine, let me use a dramatic example, when someone like Maxine Waters gets up to say something, you immediately believe whatever she says. You're not going to believe it, or it's going to be a lie or an exaggeration or something, because of who it is that's saying it. Likewise, When Mike Lee gets up there to talk, I'm going to listen to what he says.
Yes.
Because he's a serious senator, and he is an advocate, a strong advocate
he and,
for
he
individual
and Senator Paul
liberty.
Jealously guard the liberties of Americans.
It's true. So when he speaks about this briefing that they were given on why this decision was made, which presumably would include enough intelligence for them to understand how the decision was made, Mike Lee came out of there and he was furious.
Probably the worst briefing I've seen, at least on a military issue, in the 9 years I've served in the United States Senate. One of the messages we received from the briefers was, do not debate, do not discuss the issue of the appropriateness of further military intervention against Iran.
Yeah, that's the tyrannical part, where it's like, you know, that's why Mike Lee's there, you know, to debate the appropriateness of acts of war against another state.
Well, now, you know, that gets down to act of war. How and who defines what a, quote, act of war, unquote, actually is?
Well, there are judgment calls, and this is not one of them. It is an act of war to blow up somebody's general for what they're doing for their state. And if it was our general blown up by some other state, mm-hmm. We would mm-hmm. consider it an act of war, and rightly so. I don't think it's debatable, this particular act.
Okay, so if it is an act of war, then what degree of congressional oversight for this single? It's an act of war, but not a declaration of war.
Oh, yeah. No, it's.
What's the difference?
We have a messy. So. Yeah, there is no the lines are so muddied. You have to kind of that's why I said we have to kind of reimagine how this power goes, because Congress has the power to declare war, but they've given the commander in chief the ability to commit acts of war through their appropriations of soldiers, of weaponry, of all, you know, the powers that he has. So, you know, there is no easy answer. That's why I said it has to be all kind of reimagined. But one mm-hmm. thing is for sure mm-hmm. is that any time an administration official tells a congressman that it's somehow inappropriate or enabling the enemy to debate it, they should be laughed out or run out of town on a rail or whatever the functional equivalent is, because that for sure is a bunch of bunk that's designed to get us to shut up and just do whatever they say. And you know what? They would be more powerful. Just like the police, you know, would be more powerful and effective against crime if they didn't have to recognize our civil rights. But that's an untenable and unacceptable alternative. Mm-hmm. So we have to have the messy process debating it.
I agree. No question that you don't want to, as you said earlier, we cannot rest the singular power to determine war in the hands of a single person, or even a group of people separate from the normal governing process, the normal legislative process, the normal constitutional process, and the powers granted to Congress to declare war. But, you know, here's the fun part of it. Well, it's not fun. I don't want to say fun, because I think, you know, when the Democrats universally condemn the president, while essentially just brushing off the idea that this Soleimani guy was, he was a bad guy. But, and then the but goes on, you know, they'll say in five words, yes, he was a bad guy, and then go on for like paragraphs about how it was a horrible decision. And this kind of thing, Scott, you know, this emboldens a country like Iran that can easily believe that this country is so divided that they can toy with this president because he's got so much opposition at home and he's being impeached and they're shouting him down, even as we're in the midst of a frightening conflict with a sworn enemy that shouts death to America. And all the Democrats can do is pull out their Trump derangement and use it as a megaphone to oppose everything that this president is trying to do with this Iran thing, just like everything just like everything else. So play a Biden Iran, because here's the guy who is still somehow the leader in the Democratic presidential race.
Tim, without introduction, without introduction, you have started your Biden report, and that's going to be to the chagrin of many, many a listener, but I will go ahead right now, and let's just hear it from the horse's mouth, no pun intended, or no ad hominem intended.
We have not heard a sober-minded explanation to reassure the American people that this decision...
Is he, how many martinis did he have before this?
Stop, Scott, come on.
And his consequences were thought through. No level-headed words meant to dial down the tensions and to take us off the path of conflict. No press conference or consultation with our Congress.
I mean, he can't. I mean, there is a serious problem now, right, with his words. I mean, that's... What's he going to be like in the year four of a presidency?
No. What we've heard so far from this president are tweets, threats, and tantrums.
Tweets, threats, there and tantrums. Go. Very clever. I wonder how many of his campaign staff had to sit at a conference table for how long to come up with that gem that was delivered by Biden. I mean,
Tim Donner,
does anybody believe
Joe Biden for president correspondent to the Uprising podcast? Thank you for that observation.
My employment in this position has lasted, honestly, I think even longer than I thought it would, because I really
predicted a short demise for that for that position. To
and,
be
the, proven, and now
you've
it's
proven
long,
them wrong so
it's
many
a
times.
Long slow descent, long slow the long slow
well,
descent
you know,
from the Wilmington White House.
The story I wanted you to bring to the table was one I presented you with, which is that Joe Biden calls for a plastic bag ban. That is, to me, disqualifying for a president of the United States to call for the massive inconvenience that these plastic bag bans and also the deaths, Tim. Every time one of these communities institutes a plastic bag ban, there are people who will put chicken, raw chicken, in their grocery bags. They'll go back to the store and put some fresh food in there, and they will die from the infection that results from unsafe food handling practices. Plastic bags save lives. They really do.
Scott, I mean, this is an issue of deep personal importance to Joe Biden. Now, he may not have ever talked about it before until 2020, but come on. Now, how could you question his sincerity of all the things?
I love that, by the way. Do you think there was a meeting where, like, listen, this plastic bag ban, it's not going to make anybody that mad. And it seems like something these kids are excited about. Go ahead and tweet about that. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I think that's exactly what it was.
Right.
I think that they're like, give the kids something.
They call Dr. Jill in just to make sure that, you know, she thinks it's kosher. And then they go ahead and
pretend you're talking to your great grandchildren.
All right, well, let's finish up here on a positive note. I know you have this. Ricky Gervais did a seemingly great job at the Golden Globes. And what is his message, Tim, for the people?
Oh my God, Scott, I can't tell you how much this turned me on. This Ricky Gervais, an actor I frankly had never heard of before, British guy.
By the way,
it's up there.
You shouldn't announce that. He's pretty big, Tim. It does kind of.
I understand, but I'd heard of him, but I'd never seen him do anything before. I don't think I'd ever seen. I've seen a lot of movies, but you know,
you have
I didn't
heard
recognize
of him. You knew
him.
That
anyway,
he was a famous human being.
Yeah,
and so forth.
Well, I heard of him, but I'd never thought for a moment about him. And then he gets up there hosting the Golden Globes for the fifth consecutive year, and it's quite obvious from the beginning that it's his last year. He says at the beginning, you'll be happy to know this is my last year hosting this. But here it is, Ricky Gervais.
Talking of all you perverts, it was a big year. It was a big year for paedophile movies. Many talented people of colour were snubbed in major categories. Unfortunately, there's nothing we can do about that. The Hollywood foreign press are all very, very racist. So we were going to do an in memoriam this year, but when I saw the list of people that had died, it wasn't diverse enough. It just, no. It was mostly white people. Spoiler alert, season two is on the way, so in the end, he obviously didn't kill himself. Just like Jeffrey Epstein. Shut up. I know he's your friend, but I don't care. Well, you say you're woke, but the companies you work for, I mean, unbelievable. Apple, Amazon, Disney. If ISIS started a streaming service, you'd call your agent, wouldn't you? So, if you do win an award tonight, don't use it as a platform to make a political speech, right? You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg.
That's very refreshing there at the end, for sure.
I mean, just such a beatdown. And the Golden Globes, I mean, they're not the Oscars, but they're big. And it's like the 77th year they've had it. That's big. I mean, that's a big moment. And I'm not sure Hollywood really knows exactly how to process it.
From Parts Unknown, Timothy E. Donner joining me, Scott DeCosenza, and somewhere around my feet is, in fact, Archie the podcasting dog. Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
We'll see you next Uprising. Bye-bye.
Absolutely.
Combat propaganda and defend freedom at Liberty Nation Gen Z. LNGenZ.com is your portal for news, videos, and worksheets without the spin. LNGenZ.com. A free thinking future starts here.